Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. Maggie Long was born on December 17, 1999. In 2017, 17-year-old Maggie was living in Bailey, Colorado, and was a senior at Platte Canyon High School, where she was a straight-A student. She had a love for acting and spent a lot of her spare time at the local theater. On December 1, 2017, 10 days before Maggie's 18th birthday, tragedy would strike. After school that day, Maggie drove home to get ready for a concert at her school that night that she helped organize. Sadly, she would never make it. At 7:01 p.m., a 911 call came in from a person who lived in the upstairs unit of the Long family home, saying there were multiple men downstairs in the house arguing, throwing things, and trying to set the house on fire. By the time firefighters arrived at 7:12 p.m., the men were gone and the tenant upstairs was able to make it out of the house. Once the fire was extinguished, they discovered Maggie's burned remains. An investigation of the home showed clear signs of a struggle, and missing was a rifle and handgun, along with 2,000 rounds of ammo, a green safe, and jade figurines. Sketches of the men were made based on the description provided by neighbors. Investigators believe Maggie walked in on the group of men while they were burglarizing the home. At first, the case was considered a crime of opportunity, but the FBI then changed it to a hate crime. Maggie's family owns several local Chinese restaurants, and it's possible the FBI believed they were targeted because they were Asian and her parents were Chinese Vietnamese immigrants. On June 3, 2018, an attempted robbery and arson fire occurred in Warrensburg, Missouri, and was very similar to the method used in Maggie's murder. One of the two men involved in that crime also bears a striking resemblance to the sketch of one of the suspects in Maggie's case. However, even with that latest possible development, Maggie's killers have never been arrested, and as of 2024, this case remains unsolved. Margaret Alice Sweet was born on April 22, 1970, to parents James and Susan Egger in Glasgow, Montana, and went by May and graduated from Mitchell High School in 1988. May loved music, especially going to live shows, working with animals, going to Air Force Academy football games, and was always quick to help a friend in need. She loved the mountains and whitewater rafting, but also enjoyed going to the beach, especially to Destin, Florida. By 2008, May was a divorced 38-year-old woman living in Nashville, Tennessee. However, she had decided to move to Colorado Springs, where her parents lived, after breaking up with her boyfriend, 56-year-old Jerry Dale Batts. She had met him while living in Nashville, but unfortunately, the relationship was often tumultuous, and it's alleged that he physically abused her despite him claiming otherwise. However, her family had seen her with bruises and injuries on her body on several different occasions. May's best friend said that she even confided in her about the physical abuse. After moving, Jerry moved out of Nashville and followed her to Colorado Springs and started leaving things for May, such as a teddy bear, a dozen red roses, and an engagement ring in her car. This upset May, and she filed for an order of protection against him on May 13, 2008, and was granted a permanent restraining order. The abuse had been bad enough to where May was getting counseling from TESSA, an organization that helps domestic violence victims. On Christmas Eve 2008, May went to visit with her friend Tammy during the afternoon. That evening, she stopped by the hospital to visit James and her stepmother Penny, who was recovering from surgery. After leaving the hospital alone, she stopped by a drugstore before returning to her father's home. Then, around 11 p.m., neighbors overheard a loud verbal argument between an unidentified man who was yelling obscenities at May, followed by a gunshot. Sadly, for reasons unknown, the neighbors never called 911. When her father returned home at 5:50 a.m. the following day, he noticed something strange on the porch. Upon closer inspection, he realized it was May's bloody body with one leg in the basement window well. She had been fatally shot. He called 911, but it was too late, and she was pronounced dead at the scene. When investigators arrived at the scene, they found her car door open and all her valuables still inside. When investigators ran ballistic on the bullet, it linked back to a gun that was used in a drug deal in 2007. The victim who was shot during that incident survived, and no one was arrested. However, May was not likely involved in drugs, and a toxicology report showed no signs of drugs in her system at the time of her death. Jerry immediately became a person of interest and was questioned by investigators the following day. However, he claimed he was on a date with another woman at the time of the shooting. Jerry also claims he was given a polygraph exam and passed. His hands were also checked for gunshot residue, but there was nothing. It's of note that this was 8 hours later, and the residue could have easily been washed off by then. A detective working the case said that May had gotten into a verbal altercation with some people just a few days before the murder. Unfortunately, those individuals have not been identified, and there is little to no information on them. There's also another layer to this story. May was known for going online and meeting people. However, she would use the alias Shelby Jameson instead of her real name. She had even used this alias to rent an apartment in Colorado Springs, hoping it would make it difficult for Jerry to find her. Her own father said there were definitely parts of her life that he wasn't aware of. It's now been over 15 years since May was murdered, and as of 2024, her killer has not been found, and this case remains unsolved. Tracy Marie Neef was born on January 6, 1977. In 1984, 7-year-old Tracy was living in Boulder County, Colorado, with her parents, Susan and Gary. On the morning of March 16, 1984, Tracy was dropped off at her school, Bertha Hyde Elementary School, in Thornton. Unfortunately, on that particular morning, Susan was running late and didn't drop Tracy off at school until 8:20 a.m., at which point the schoolyard was already empty. Typically, Tracy would gather with her other classmates on the playground and wait for the teachers to come out and get them. Once they were inside, the back door where they usually entered was locked, and students were left to enter through the front entrance where they had to sign in if they were running late. When Susan dropped Tracy off, she saw her heading toward the front of the school and drove away, never to see her daughter again. When Susan returned at 2:45 p.m. to pick her up from school, she never came out. She waited a few minutes, thinking her daughter was running late, but once again, there was no Tracy. She then thought that maybe she decided to walk home and began driving slowly back toward the house, expecting to see Tracy, but sadly, she never did. Once Susan arrived home and didn't see her, she rushed back to the elementary school. After parking and walking in, she found Tracy's teacher, and panic immediately set in when she learned Tracy had never been at school that day. She then drove home and called her husband Gary, who immediately left work and drove home as quickly as possible. They spent the next 45 minutes driving around the neighborhood looking for their daughter, but she was nowhere to be found. By 4 p.m., they decided to report her missing. At that point, law enforcement joined in on the search. 40 miles away in Nederland, at around 4:45 p.m., a couple walking their dog at Barker Meadow Reservoir in Boulder Canyon shockingly found Tracy's body. It was located in a grassy area not far from where Colorado Highway 119 cuts through Boulder. School supplies were scattered near her body, and her backpack was located about 100 feet away. The ligature marks found on both her wrist showed that she had been restrained before the murder. They believe this was done because she was trying to fight back. She also had ligature marks around her chin, which they determined came from the strap on her coat. They theorized that her killer likely tried to keep her quiet by tying her jacket tightly around her mouth, leaving a mark in the process. Poor little Tracy had been sexually assaulted and suffocated to death, not directly by the killer himself, but by her coat that he accidentally tied so tight that she couldn't breathe. Her father, Gary, believed that his daughter knew her killer because he felt she would have never gotten into a car with a stranger. Before her murder, several girls in the Denver area had reported being sexually assaulted by an unknown man who then let them go. Investigators believed the same man might have abducted Tracy. If so, he had likely intended to release her after he assaulted her, but had accidentally killed her. School employees and Tracy's family members were ruled out as suspects. They also investigated multiple persons of interest who had been convicted of sex offenses since 1979, but none led to her killer. In 1998, they attempted to extract DNA from a hair that was found on her body, but it was unfortunately contaminated during the process. Sadly, her parents, unable to cope with the loss of their daughter, divorced a year after her death. A person of interest in the case is Aaron Schonlau, who was convicted of murdering Alicia Woolsey Ruff, who went by Lacey. Lacey was camping with her mother at a Nini Beach Park in Hawaii on July 27, 1993, when Aaron abducted her. He then sexually assaulted her before drowning her. In 1984, Aaron and his brother Todd lived only a few blocks from Tracy and had only been in Hawaii for about a week before Lacey's murder. Before her body was found, Todd had called the police and turned his brother in. After being arrested and charged, Aaron was convicted for the abduction, sexual assault, and murder of Lacey and sentenced to life in prison. It's now believed that Todd was there and possibly took part in covering up the crime and turned his brother in to take the focus off himself. He even allegedly confessed this to his girlfriend in 2012. There's also the fact that Todd was the one who took the police to where Lacey's body was found and knew details that only someone there would have known. However, the police in Hawaii do not seem interested in convicting anyone else, and because of that, Todd remains a free man. Unfortunately, as of 2024, Tracy's killer has never been found, and this case remains unsolved. Violet Rose Newman was born on June 30, 1923. In 1980, 57-year-old Violet was living in Centennial, Colorado, with her husband, Ronald Newman, and their four adult children. Violet was described as a hardworking mother and wife and was employed in retail at May D&F at what was then the South Glen Mall. On October 25, 1980, Violet left work at about 5 p.m. and was last seen walking toward her car. After going bowling, Ronald arrived home around 7:30 p.m., and since Violet wasn't there, he figured she was coming home late and went on to bed. When he woke up around 1:30 a.m. and found she was still not there, he called his son Greg, who had just moved out of the family home, to ask if he'd seen her. When he said no, he called the police and reported her missing. The next afternoon, hikers found Violet's body off the path in the Castlewood Canyon. She was nude and covered by debris and a plain white sheet. She had been sexually assaulted and then shot execution style. Deputies found her station wagon 3 blocks from Violet's home. When investigators searched the car, they found a large amount of blood in the passenger seat, leading them to believe she was shot from behind while sitting in the car. This tells me that after he sexually assaulted her, he put her back in the car on the passenger side, shot her, and then drove her to where her body was ultimately found. However, what's interesting is that the car was found 3 blocks from her home. At first, I thought he knew where she lived, but now I think it's a coincidence, since the mall was only a mile from the Newman family home. Let me know what y'all think in the comments. A witness actually saw the man who ultimately abandoned the car and described him as a young white man. The witness said the car was left between 7 and 8 p.m. on the day she went missing. The same day, a woman reported being approached by a male with a firearm demanding a ride in the May D&F parking lot. He claimed to need a ride because he had stolen from his brother. Thankfully, the woman was able to quickly drive off before the man could do anything to her. That same man was seen getting into a red truck and was described as a young white man with red hair and a pug nose. While they can't confirm they are the same man, they believe that's most likely the case. DNA from the sexual assault kit was preserved back in 1980, and in 2004, a DNA sample was obtained. While it didn't lead to a suspect, they at least now have a DNA profile and were able to eliminate several suspects. Meanwhile, immediately after Violet's death, suspicion fell upon her oldest child, Scott. He was then institutionalized shortly after the murder and died of natural causes in 1998 before being released. Violet's daughter, Jill, became estranged from the family after the murder because of her alleged connection to satanic beliefs and witchcraft. She also allegedly left a voodoo doll in her mother's casket at the funeral. When Ronald passed away, Jill never claimed the inheritance that was left for her. Her murder even took a toll on her son, Mark, who became very disturbed after his mother's murder and was diagnosed with severe depression and anxiety. He now lives off his disability in the confines of his home. Her other child, Greg, went on to run a prominent real estate business in Denver. Hopefully, detectives, along with the help of genetic genealogy, can take the DNA profile and track down the killer. But as of 2024, her case remains unsolved. Ian Kirk Wilcoxon was born on February 22, 1992. In 2017, 24-year-old Ian was a Navy veteran living with a friend in Boone, Colorado, and also lived part-time in Conroe, Texas. He moved to Colorado in the summer of 2016 after he was laid off and got a job on a marijuana farm there. On January 3, 2017, he bought groceries and contacted the landlord in Texas to say that he would pay the rent when he returned. He had plans to catch a flight in Denver on the morning of January 4th, heading back to Texas, but unfortunately, that flight was canceled due to inclement weather. After sending a text message to someone at 10 a.m. that morning, he has never been heard from again. By the next day, on January 5th, the phone had either died or been turned off. When Ian left, he took his cell phone, keys, wallet, and a gun with him. Those items have never been found. There has also been no activity on his bank accounts since he disappeared. Unfortunately, there are a lot of unanswered questions in this case. Did he leave for his flight unaware that it was canceled? I saw online that he doesn't have either vehicle with him, which tells me he had two vehicles and didn't leave in either one of them on January 4th. Also, who is his roommate and what do they know? What was the last text message he sent at 10 a.m.? Since the property he lived on showed no signs of a struggle or foul play, I assume Ian either left on foot or got in a car with someone. The address he was staying at in Colorado was only a couple of miles from the Arkansas River. Since his gun was missing, did he take it and go out exploring since his flight was canceled and something unexpected happened? Also, what kind of gun was it? According to weather reports, there was no snowfall in the area on January 3rd or 4th. But the high temperatures were below freezing. Investigators, however, believe someone knows what happened to him. I would love to hear y'all's theories on this. Sadly, there are so many things left unknown, and as of 2024, Ian has never been found, and this case remains unsolved. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time.